mid-70s, I'm trying to picture how the concept of bioregionalism got into your head. Because, I'd interviewed Peter Berg many years ago of the Planet Drum Foundation, and that's how I learned about how to look at things in terms of a bioregion. And he said, now look at place where you live. All those rivers end with ish, that suffix, Snohomish, Duwamish, and what have you. Which, and he said, that's from the native language, Lashut seed or Walshut seed.
And I
joked that, and it means kill the white man with a hatchet. but it doesn't. What it means is the people of that particular river.
Of that river, right. Upriver and downriver.
Right. So how did you first learn about bioregionalism?
Well, I went to graduate school in New York City and then finished up at the University of Oregon and wanted to come home. And then that wanting to come home, it was fabulous living in the city and East Coast and so on. And it's, you need to leave home. Everybody needs to leave home. So this is not about provincialism at all. It's about the bioregionalism is about ever deeper levels of relationality. So when I give a critique of something, it does not mean that I am negating it, essentially, but trying to put it in a larger context. So in the mid-late 70s, I was finishing the dissertation. I spent 76 on an NIH fellowship in Berkeley with Robert Bella. Out of that came the Habits of the Heart book, out of that people in that seminar. In Habits of the Heart, Bella and his co-writers had a nice little phrase in there where they were talking about community, right? And the loss of community. It was Reagan's era. And Reagan was doing to American economy and community. I was listening to Springsteen the other day. My hometown, he puts a kid on his lap and takes him around. And they say, jobs are going now, son. Take a good look around. This is your hometown. And I had the feeling of this fundamental pervasive perfidy that the people in charge of the economy and the politics and the culture were perfidious. They were losing faith. They may say they were conservatives, may say they were, but they were selling us all out. And we saw that with Reagan's era's Rape of the Forest here, and the Rape of the Forest by the Reagan regime here was the start of one of the great land use battles over the old growth and then salmon in the 20th century. And that was basically the back to the landers after the Cambodian invasion and Reagan there. So the bioregionalists were the first ones to dig their heels in and swear this fierce loyalty, identification, and defense of the place, of their own backyards. It began with against toxic spraying. It began with various things, but then it coalesced into the old growth. And that was one of the great crusades of the last part of the century. But I felt it on many levels that the same kind of perfidy that we were seeing in the forest was going on with the economy and the culture. And the people in charge were actually undermining things, Reagan being a classic example of that. So chafing at, having to finish classes and degrees, I had everything done for the doctoral degree at 23 in New York City. At 23, what do you know? You don't know anything at 23. You're just barely trying to master a language, an abstract language. So I came home, dropped out, came back here, worked in a mill, worked in a cannery, did construction, taught night school, and then I moved up to Seattle U. And I needed something to ground me in the real world. I was obviously very successful in that abstraction conceptualization world, but it didn't seem real. So anyway, I taught at Seattle U and then came back down here to finish at Oregon and then went to Berkeley. But throughout all of that, where the world was changing on its axis and disintegrating, I felt like I was not in it, part of it. And one day I said, why the hell do I know more about a 12th century village than I know about my home place, my region? And there was kind of this existential shift on an axis, snap as it were, in about 77. And the books, I began signing Cascadia in there. Now, Ecotopia was big at that time, and everybody read it, but Ecotopia was useful as a story that did two things. It gave us a narrative against the Reaganite onslaught, against the forests and so on, and it kind of institutionalized Berkeley environmental consumerism from the 70s. I was there. I knew exactly, you know, what the Berkeley in the late mid 76, 77 was like, and that was what Ecotopia and Kallenbach wrote. And it was it's a very lame story, and Ecotopia 2 emerging was unreadable. And so it became iconic up here, but it never led anywhere because it was another topia. And I became not interested in it at all. And Cascadia was among those searching for a grounded alternative and digging in their heels to fight for the life of their place and for their families and economies. Cascadia began to seep in, and I caught the bug, and it was a new myth. And I'd heard about it before. Freeman House, for instance, on Whidbey was talking about Cascadia. Key people in Eugene were talking about Cascadia and projecting all kinds of utopian images into it. But then I finally found Kallenbach's book, Cascadia, The Geologic Evolution of the Pacific Northwest. And I thought, here's the start. This is great. And I love the cover. It had Mount St. Helens on the cover. And I thought, now this is it. And it was a valuable book in a way because it's the first one that treated the Pacific Northwest along with BC as a whole. It harkened back to the first myth of the place, which was, from the geologists in the turn of the century, was in the beginning there was Appalachia and Cascadia, and these were these two great outliers on either side of North America. And they gave themselves up. Cascadia was this mythical landmass off in the North Pacific that eroded away, and they knew because the sediments washed westward. Well, off of the Rockies and the Cascades, the sediments would wash eastward. Normally, off the Pacific slope, you'd find sediments washing westward toward the ocean, right? So there must have been something there. So Cascadia was this myth of the geologists and botanists around the turn of the century, from about 1895 or so to about 1914. It was wholly the construct, though, of a geologist, a historical paleontologist at Yale, Schuchert, who was one of the great Edenic figures of all time. He created hundreds of names for mythical continents and made all these maps of paleogeography for 50 years. He was the dean of paleogeography. Well, that's what it just was a myth. And people believed in it for a while, and then the underlying dynamic of the geology faded, and they no longer believed in synclines and geosynclines until right here off our shores in the 1960s, a new myth was being created, a new form of earth poetry, and the geologists here created plate tectonics out of our subduction zones and transformed faults and so on. That's a fabulous story all into it, so most people don't know it.
And that's talking about the Cascadia subduction zone.
Yeah, before it had a name, it didn't have a name. So over and over again, this term, Cascadia, which the geologists, the 19th century geologists, derived from, of course, the Cascade Mountains. And then you go back and you say, what were the Cascade Mountains named after? They were named after the Cascades of the great Cascades of the Columbia River. Just these fearsome series of, or Dalles, Salado Falls, which was the great one, and then the chute. Lewis and Clark called it the chute, the Great Cascades. And that was where the Bonneville landslide in the earthquake of 1706 or 1710 brought down that, what the Indians called the Bridge of the Gods, that dammed up the Columbia and caused the Great Cascades. Well, boy, I started diving into that myth, and what's this resonance that Cascadia is speaking to us over a series of generations here? And it's a search for a new name, for a name that's true to the spirit of the place. And it's named Cascadia not after the mountains, but as in the original naming, it's named after the dynamism of the waters. And that's why Cascadia is a verb first. So all of this began to unpack and unfold out of Bates McKee's book in 1972. Now, there's just, stay with me a minute more on Bates McKee's. Bates McKee's book in 1972 was a college textbook. He was at UW, and it was pre-tectonic. There was no explanatory causal mechanism that had anything to do, except hinted at, for a contemporary thing. Plus, Cascadia had no explanatory narrative function in the book. It didn't function in the book at all. And so this is quite when you really begin to read the book, it's quite a, I love the image of the book and what the book seemed to evoke, but it wasn't in the book. So where did Cascadia as a bioregion, as a dynamism from us, from me, from the bioregionalists, we're the ones who gave Cascadia the contemporary notion as a bioregion that is blessed or created by all these dynamisms.